Part 1. Jesus Lives Now. 1. A Real Man. Wherever you and I find ourselves at this moment, we share something in common in connection with the man Jesus Christ. We have come together to learn more of him. Before we even begin, however, we can immediately discover one fact that will be true for both of us, and it is an important fact. We don't embark on this journey with a clean slate. Our brains are already full of ideas about Jesus, preconceptions, and images. Every one of us, whether we've thought about it or not, possess a series of mental pictures embedded in our consciousness, from his physical features to what he wore, from how he spoke to the crowds to the circumstances and setting of the crucifixion. Mostly, we are all full of ideas about Jesus, beliefs and opinions, some no doubt accurate and some inaccurate, things we've been taught, things we've read or heard, maybe conclusions we've drawn on our own. Whether you consider yourself one of his followers or not, whether you are a pastor, a priest, a layman, a man, a woman, a child, you cannot escape this fact. Neither can I. We're full of impressions that color and distort the way we respond to everything we hear about Jesus. They influence how we hear and receive the words he spoke. At the mention of his name, a dozen mental pictures and opinions concerning this or that all rise in your brain no less than they do mine. To undertake an exploration in any field of endeavor requires a recognition of where one happens to be at the outset, and with respect to an inquiry about Jesus, this is where you and I find ourselves. We have to recognize that we are not in the position of a jungle native of the 19th century listening to the Christian missionary speak of Jesus, who, hearing his name for the first time, looks up with puzzled expression and says, "Who? I have never heard of this person." These preconceptions we bring to this discussion are a huge stumbling block. They obscure our capacity to probe the gospel account in a way that unlocks fresh understanding. Our mental slates are already too full. Increasing this hindrance, the pages of the gospel on which the story is presented, by their very appearance, look like a religious document. They do not contain the same power to draw us into their drama with big eyes and pumping hearts and senses fully awake as does a widescreen THX Hollywood thriller. The double columns and footnotes and marginal references on the page of almost any Bible you pick up look stale and dry and impersonal as a text to be studied, not a drama to be lived. And if we're reading the account in 17th century King James English, the barriers to intimacy become insurmountable. How can we possibly get into the story if people are calling each other thee and thou and using words like wouldest and doth and verily and brethren? We've never heard people talk like that in our lives. We are used to personal, real, gripping, intimate edge-of-your-seat stuff. But we don't find it in a double-column footnoted ye, hath, and shouldest account. So how can we put ourselves into the drama, and how can we make it live? How can we rip up the top sheet of our mental slates to clear them of our preconceptions and images? How can we approach the gospel account fresh, as if we've never heard it before, as if we are really there? Let's turn that question around. Perhaps the imperative upon us is not so much to put ourselves into the gospel world, but to bring the gospel into our world. To read it not as if we were there, but as if the gospel story suddenly exploded to life here. To read as if somehow we were being drawn right into the center of it. We have to realize what it was like for Peter, James, John, Andrew, Mary, Martha, Lazarus, Mary Magdalene, and all the rest of the people who found themselves swept into the story we are so familiar with. They were just going about in the midst of very ordinary lives when suddenly the big bang of history swept them up into it like a human tornado. To those unsuspecting residents of Capernaum and Magdala and Cana and other small towns throughout Galilee, the name Jesus was like any other common name of the day. In their ears, it sounded like Bob, Harry, Jess, or Ralph would to us. When they first made his acquaintance, it wasn't an occurrence of epic proportions. As if one day a man in a white robe walked up to you or me and said in solemn tones to the accompaniment of thunder in the sky, "My name is Jesus." We would be stunned. Such an event would leave us speechless and with mouth gaping open. But for the people of his day, though their mouths would hang open in astonishment soon enough, at first, it wasn't like that at all. They had no clue who he was. To get a feel for the reality of it, imagine the following. "Hello, Peter. My name is Jess. I'm a carpenter from over in Centerville." "Hey, how's it going, Jess? Call me Pete." "How's the fishing today?" "Not so good." "Interested in catching something better than just fish?" I'm not sure what you mean." "Then come with me, and I'll tell you about it." It was down-to-earth stuff. Real. Now, please don't get me wrong. They knew something was unique about this extraordinary Nazarene right from the beginning. Nothing else can explain the sudden impact throughout Galilee the moment he burst on the scene. But they didn't know what that uniqueness was, because in the midst of that uniqueness, he was a human being just like them. He felt things. He got hungry. He had to eat. His hair got dirty. His feet got dusty. He sweat and smelled just like any other person. He had to go to the bathroom. Jesus didn't float along 6 inches off the ground. He was a man. He lived life as we must live it. That very manhood is what made it so difficult for those closest to him to figure out who he really was. Does such talk make you squirm a bit? As if I am despiritualizing the sanctity of our Lord's life? We have to despiritualize it somewhat in order to understand what really went on and to grasp the enormous spiritual significance of a seemingly ordinary man suddenly working miracles and calling himself the Christ. I don't think one is ready to lay hold of the import of Jesus' life and character until he can place side by side in his brain 2 startling facts. If he didn't wash them, Jesus' feet smelled. And he was the Son of God. We cannot begin to comprehend the magnificence of the incarnation until we apprehend the reality of Jesus' manhood. So the people surrounding Jesus in the gospel story were no different from you and me. They were just men and women like the rest of us. They were, however, different in this way. They weren't taught about Jesus. They didn't find out about him from a leather-bound, double-column edition of papyrus scroll they bought from the synagogue bookstore. They found out about him because all of a sudden, there he was in their midst, a compelling man whose words were like nothing they'd ever heard, and who was himself like no other person who had ever lived. Unlike us, they were like the native asking, "Who?" As much as possible, then, we've got to put ourselves in their sandals. From Jesus, an Obedient Son, by Michael Phillips. Read by Michael Kimball. More information on this and similar writings may be found at fatheroftheinklings.com. Visit Amazon to purchase Jesus, an Obedient Son, and other books by Michael Phillips.